So we're really excited to be here today. I just want to tell you a little bit about the rest of our team who couldn't make it. This has really been a team effort project. So Seema and I have worked on it along with Blaine Ferrari, who is about to graduate and go on to Nurse Midwifery School, public health student. Bela Ostrak, who's a PhD medical anthropologist, and Joanne Wilkinson, who's a family physician. We have no disclosures. This project was funded by a trainee grant from the Society of Family Planning. And just to give you a little bit of background, I want to talk for a minute about intellectual disability. So formally called mental retardation, we're really avoiding that word at this point, rightfully. It's offensive. Very much a disparity group, both in terms of health and social conditions and social determinants of health. Things like living in poverty, high rates of unemployment and underemployment, lack of access to communities and the parts of communities that promote health, and are very understudied and frankly have a pretty long history of research abuses perpetrated against them. And within the realm of health and health disparities and health inequity for people with intellectual disabilities, sexual and reproductive health is particularly understudied and underdressed and under-accessed. And part of this has to do with the disability experience itself and kind of a stigmatized view of sexuality for adults with intellectual disabilities. And then intellectual disability itself can intensify the general population barriers to sexual and reproductive health. So there's a lot we don't know, but we do know that huge disparities in access. So this study was a pilot study. So all the research that we have about the sexual and reproductive health care needs of this population has really focused on people other than adults with intellectual disabilities themselves. So there's a lot of research, a lot in the sense of like 30 articles, talking to parents and caregivers and clinicians, but not much data about women themselves. So this study, our aim was to be as inclusive as possible and really understand the barriers to reproductive health care for women with intellectual disabilities from their own perspectives. So we had a two-pronged strategy for data collection. We did qualitative interviews, which are ongoing. We've completed 12. And we used a method called Photo Voice, which Seema will talk to you about a little bit.
So what is Photo Voice? Photo Voice is a participatory research strategy that enables people who must overcome barriers such as poverty, race, ethnicity, class, gender, culture, or other circumstances to use photo images to capture and explain aspects of their environment and experiences. The theoretical framework was developed by Caroline Wang to look at how society, politics, and power relationships affect one's own situation. So there are three main goals with Photo Voice. It's to record and reflect on experiences by highlighting community strengths and weaknesses, to promote and encourage dialogue about personal and community issues, and to reach the intended audience and the general public about these issues in order to bring change and improve conditions. So why does this Photo Voice method work with people with intellectual disabilities? It gives the opportunity to participate and employ control in the research process. It gives them an empowering experience by giving them the ability to develop new skills. It also increases their confidence, and they get to experience inclusiveness in their own terms. So patient-provider communication was one of the things that we got from the interviews, including relationship with their physician and their comfort and interest of talking about reproductive health topics with their provider. So generally, the women said their doctor was nice and they liked their doctor. However, when it came to decision-making, patients felt they had little power to make their own decision about their own health care. And the common topics that were discussed with their provider was menstruation. However, there were no mention of talking about sexual experiences, family planning, prevention of STIs, and no cervical cancer screening or prevention of HPV. And these are the positive, negative, and mixed reviews on how they feel about talking about reproductive health care with their provider. They prefer physicians to explain what they're going to do before they touch the patient. Explanations about medication, procedures again. And they prefer female physicians over male physicians. And they would like for physicians to talk about their own healthcare experience and their own experience with reproductive health. That way they can have this relationship about talking about it with the provider. There's a mixed consensus on asking doctor questions. They felt embarrassed to talk about these things. And they also mentioned that age also played a role. They felt that they were able to talk about these topics with younger physicians. However, they also said that older physicians are easy to talk to because they have more experience in the field. So there's, again, a mixed consensus on that.
So I'll talk a little bit about another theme we had, which was sexual education, that Blaine's analyzed as a master's in education, so it's been really helpful for our team. And so women in this study reported having very little to no access to sexual education, and I'll talk in a little bit when we talk about some of the barriers to decision-making. The framing of the education or the methods used really varied a lot, too. So the education that women did get was often more focused on telling women that sex was bad rather than talking about means of preventing STIs, pregnancy, making informed choices. And so only two of the 12 women interviewed had taken a sexual health education class. So here's some quotes that we thought were very illustrative. So the participant said, "I took a class a few years ago," and the interviewer asked, "Was it here?" "No, not here. I had to go to another town," which in a population that generally doesn't drive, has limited access to transportation, that can be a really big deal. Again, we asked, "Have you ever had any classes or anything like that?" "No." "Is that something you'd like to learn more about?" "If I had the time, yeah." So it was relevant information, but not information that women had ready access to. And we felt that sexual education was particularly important given the very, very high rates of reported abuse. And, you know, we know that for every case of abuse that's reported, there are many, many others that go unreported. And this population has some very specific barriers to reporting, kind of even beyond the barriers in the general population. So we felt that appropriate sex education, the literature has really shown that appropriate sex education has been really helpful in both preventing abuse, in giving women skills to, you know, say no, get out of the situation, get help, but also in teaching women how to recognize abuse and name abuse, which can often be the first step in ending abuse. And so there's some evidence, too, for incorporating sexual abuse education into general education. May also help increase comfort in what Seema was talking about, having a conversation about sexual health at all with the provider. Another thing that came up a lot was relationships, and so I should be really clear that we were, in our interview guide, we were very careful to ask questions in a gender-neutral way and not assume heterosexuality, although women in answering the questions all answered thinking of partners as men. So we went with it in our analysis. So there was this idea that having a boyfriend or a romantic relationship was a way of belonging, of being just like everyone else, which was an important thing to this population. So a boyfriend is a good thing to have. Or when asked about her goals, a woman responded, "Oh, well, I'll probably get married." Other women talked about enjoying the single life, and I love this quote. I relate to it personally. I'm just happy the way I am. Single life is good. But kind of coupled with that desire for relationships or that comfort with being single or on one's own was also this theme that came up of sex being very, very dangerous. So these are things that potentially could be combated with access to sexual and reproductive health care, things like, "I'm not sexually active," because you never know with AIDS and stuff like that. So we know that HIV is preventable, but the women in this study didn't know about means of preventing HIV and other STI transmissions. Men are too controlling, some of them. Just be careful. I think you should protect your own self, and protecting one's own self meant avoiding all contact with men. don't chance it. I just feel like I don't want to get hurt. I've heard stories about people and this, and no, not me. I'm not going to have a romantic relationship or a sexual relationship. Which, again, I mean, I think, you know, there's risk to everything in life, but without access to sexual and reproductive health services, the risk is much greater than it would be with that access. And this last quote is just sort of heartbreaking for us. People touch me, and when I say no, you got to stop. You have to push it out, push them away. So this was someone who, you know, was a trauma survivor and really didn't have access to any services or supports to address this. And so we think that this lack of education combined with this perception of risk really translated into a lack of control or decision-making authority about one's own sexual and reproductive health. And so we heard a lot of participants, when talking about sexual and reproductive health care, describe their experiences as something I did that was fine, you know, I can have a PAP, but it wasn't my choice. The doctor decided, and I had this procedure, or the doctor decided, and I now take contraceptives. And this last one, the doctor, he said he'd tie my tubes and then not have a baby. The second to last one. You know, given that this population has such a long and terrible, frankly, history of forced sterilization and eugenics, it's really disturbing to hear that this is still going on, that we're still, you know, living that history. It hasn't really effectively been addressed, and women feel that their sexual and reproductive health choices are being made for them. Possibly because, you know, I never talk about that with anyone. I prefer not to ask about that. That's embarrassing. So this was a woman talking about, as Seema described, a clinician with whom she had a very positive relationship, but she still felt that she wasn't accessing the sexual and reproductive health care that she desired. And so these were the conclusions from our study so far. And like I said, our study is ongoing. But so though women, again, liked their providers, they still had a lot of barriers to discussing sexual and reproductive health care, particularly when the clinician didn't raise the issue on their own and left it to the participant to raise, which I think we all know is hard in the general population to raise this topic on one's own. And so it seemed like, as participants described it anyway, providers were unprepared to discuss sexual health with women with intellectual disabilities. And gaps in sex education contributed to gaps in sexual health care access, and also contributed to women's sense that no matter what, I can't have sex because I'll get AIDS, versus I can make decisions about this because I have the information I need to prevent transmission of STIs. And we think that this perception of sex as dangerous may lead to some risky sexual and reproductive health care practices, which remains unstudied, but it's a hypothesis. And we think this lack of decisional control might contribute to both patient-provider communication difficulties and access gaps. And so the last thing I want to talk about in the, 1.5 minutes we have left is some of the roadblocks to our Photo Voice project, which is just now a year into this grant beginning. And we view this as just another data point in terms of societal and cultural views of sexual and reproductive health care for this population. So our first major roadblock was from our Institutional Review Board, or IRB, who felt that probably we're going to be producing pornography, which, you know, we were not going to be doing. We'd be making a lot more money than we do if we were porn producers. We're not. And our community partners, so we do a lot of research related to women's health care and primary care with adults with intellectual disabilities, and we're very community-based. We have a strong network of community partners. And unlike our other studies, it was very difficult to locate a community partner who wanted to participate in this study. I think a lot of our partners felt like, you know, personally, I want to do this, but I don't think there's room in the agency to do it. I think it might alienate the parents and family members of these adults. And for adults who do have legal guardians, which not every adult with intellectual disabilities does, but some do, community partners feared guardian reactions and losing trust with the guardians of their participants.
really interesting thing from our IRB, one of the things that makes me drink late at night when I think about it, is this IRB meeting I went to where this question kept coming up of, well, can they use cameras? Are they capable of expressing themselves? And, you know, for us, our aim with inclusive research, our aim with inclusive research is to really enable adults everywhere to speak for themselves. Though women with intellectual disabilities are perceived as not having agency or are voiceless, they actually really have a lot to say. And our challenge as researchers is to find the means to allow them to say that. So this question of can they do this was really upsetting for us. And even more upsetting was this question of, but what if they take a photograph that could potentially be embarrassing? Will they know to be embarrassed? Which, you know, again, kind of speaks to this point of how much we need more participatory research about this topic. So really quick, our future directions, our project is starting. We think we need to develop some interventions for women, definitely for clinicians. We need some education for clinicians about how to cross the barriers of communication. And we need further collaborative research. And I left some handouts in the back, a plain language summary, which we provide to our community partners, and a poster about, you know, more of the results of the study. Thank you. We have been trying to get funding for our project to interview providers. If anyone knows of any good grant sources, can talk to us. that's very much a study we'd love to do, particularly given a lot of the themes you were talking about, Seema, about kind of how women perceive their providers. And then in terms of agency, I think that's crucial. The first thing that comes to mind for me is a project I did several years ago now looking at aging in women with intellectual disabilities. So we were interviewing people who, for the most part, grew up in institutions. And then when deinstitutionalization happened, people moved into the community in their 30s and 40s. So for that generation, it's really interesting. They felt like they had a lot more agency. I did a photo voice project about that, and one of my favorite photos from that photo voice project was a co-researcher with intellectual disabilities, took a photo of a carton of chocolate milk, like a specific Moo Milk brand. And it didn't seem like at first it just seemed like sort of like doodling with her camera. And then part of the photo voice process is talking with the participant or the co-researcher, because it's very much about kind of co-production of knowledge, talking with the co-researcher about what does this photo mean, why did you take it? And so for her, the fact that she was able to go to the store with a staff person, select her favorite beverage, pack her own lunch, and include the chocolate milk she preferred, for her really represented having a lot of agency that she hadn't had in her younger years. These interviews, most people were in between, I think the youngest participant was 23 and the oldest was 59. So the younger participants, I think, were more aware of comparing themselves to their peers without disabilities and noticing, I have less agency than my friend so-and-so who I went to school with, who doesn't have Down syndrome or doesn't have intellectual disability. So I think while that's upsetting for people to know that they have less agency than their friend without a disability, I think kind of overall culturally, it's maybe a positive step that we're defining agency as things a lot more fundamental than, you know, whether you get to drink chocolate milk or Do they make strawberry milk? You know, like some other flavor? Population in particular, and I want to be very clear that I'm incredibly grateful that there is an IRB process when, you know, when I think about the ways this population has been abused and treated by research. It's really clear to me we need a new paradigm for doing research, and I think that may apply to other vulnerable populations. I think the thing our IRB has struggled with the most is kind of our participatory, inclusive ethic that they really question. Well, how can a person with an intellectual disability be your co-researcher? And so that, I mean, I feel like that's the thing. I'll do whatever they want, but I'm going to throw down with them on the, will this person feel embarrassment? Yes, she's a person. And yes, she has a right to define what's embarrassing to her. I mean, we all have different things that embarrass us. And I think it's, as much as we can, you know, night drinking aside, I think, I sound like an alcoholic, I'm not, but I think, you know, aside from, like, needing to take comments with a glass of wine, I think really, I have this fantasy of, like, bringing some of my co-researchers with intellectual disabilities to IRB meetings. In one way we've tried to work around the issue, which we don't have the funding for currently, but, you know, in fantasy land, I would really like to hire members of vulnerable populations and make it very clear on paper to the IRB that they're designing this study, so that's a protection. They're helping to conduct this study, so that's a protection. They're really looking out for their own community in a way that, you know, as a person without a disability, maybe I can't. And I think, you know, there's some good research, too, about how exposure to a population increases tolerance in general. So if IRB members are interacting with people with intellectual disabilities in their daily life, they're much less likely to say, well, can she operate a camera? Than if my project is the first time they're really considering people with intellectual disabilities. So I think it's maybe a cultural shift of becoming more inclusive as a world will help with the IRB problem.
Great. Thank you.